I think I'm still jet lagging from the hour, the time change. Anybody else still kind of figure out where we are sometime? Pretty weather. Hope for some rain this week. Maybe we'll get some. Need some. We're going to talk about Joseph today. Large subject. Brother Mike's in a gospel meeting, I believe, in New Boston, Texas, starting this morning over outside of Texarkana. And he asked if I could fill in this morning. So we're going to do that. And he said the subject was Joseph. So we're going to try to lay some foundation groundwork for the character of Joseph. Okay. To talk about Joseph, anybody remember what son or what number son he was from the from his father Jacob? What number? Well, let me just say this. How many sons were there? Anybody remember the 11th? Anybody remember the oddball daughter? There was a daughter born too of that of Jacob. Can you imagine being a daughter of 13 brothers or 12 brothers? Dinah, wasn't that her name? Dinah. And so it's kind of an interesting thing. I know a guy that had like I think it was 7 girls, and he finally got a son, and so everybody felt sorry for the son. But anyway. If you're going to study the character of Joseph, he is a major context, a major portion of the book of Genesis. He takes up the last part of Genesis, and when you can compare content of the book of Genesis, you're probably talking about maybe almost a third of the book of Genesis pertains to really the character of Joseph. And he is the 11th son born of Jacob, and do you remember his mother? Do you remember the mother of Joseph? I'm just kind of asking some questions just to kind of lay out some groundwork. How many wives did Jacob have? Which one did he marry first? And then which one did he marry second? How many years did he have to work for either one of them? 14 years to get married. Man, I'd probably just decided to stay like Paul. But yes, Rachel is the mother of Joseph. Who was the other brother, the second brother? She only had two. Benjamin. And did she survive during Benjamin's birth or during the process? So that's kind of some of the interesting information. Does anybody have an idea, I'm just curious, of what transpires as a result of the character of Joseph? What, if I were to ask it in this way, why is so much content in the book of Genesis, chapter 37 really, all the way to the end of the book, chapter 50, why is so much content centered around the character of Joseph? Right. So, Randy said that through Joseph, the nation of Israel will be saved. Is that representing kind of what you were saying? Saved from what? Their identity being lost? Anybody else have a comment on Joseph? Right, and you remember Joseph will interpret a dream while he's in there to help save not only Egypt but the nations around them by setting up somewhat of a welfare system, if you really analyze it, but a system that wouldn't have been permanent. But anyway, You had the 7 years of fat and the 7 years of famine. But what about Genesis chapter 15? Let's go back to Genesis chapter 15 to lay the groundwork, because the Bible is, I suppose the word is, an intentional book. It gets to a point. It was written with a purpose. It's not some random series of stories without a purpose in mind. That's what's so unique about the Bible. The Bible is such a specific book with a specific purpose. And one of the things that's interesting to me is the amount of content, and that's why I mentioned content, surrounding Isaac's character, who is the father of Jacob and Esau, and then really the character of Jacob, whose name is changed to Israel. There's a little bit of content there about him, but Abraham and Joseph are your two really major patriarchal characters in the book of Genesis. Just as an earmark note in your mind or in your notes, think about that, but then think about the purpose of that. There's a reason why. Remember in Genesis 15 what's going on here. And God will encourage Abraham because of Abraham's complaint, or perhaps struggling with the promise of having a child. And Abraham said, of course, in verse 2, "Wilt thou give me, what wilt thou give me, seeing I go childless?" Talking about a seed, they still have not had a seed, an heir, a fulfilling of the promise that Abraham would be the heir of the world through his seed, and that all nations would be blessed as a result of Abraham. And Abraham's struggling with that promise. And I want you to remember this context. It's where he looks up to heaven to see if he can count the stars. In verse 5, he's reminded of the promise. But look at verse 13. Genesis 15, verse 13. "And he said unto Abram, Know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. And also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance. And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace, thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." This is God speaking to Abraham, Abram. This is God speaking to Abram before he's even had a child. Ishmael hasn't even been born yet. The next chapter, Genesis 16, is where they grow impatient with God again, and Hagar, her handmaid, is handed to Abram, and that's the relationship that creates Ishmael. But here's God reminding Abraham that there's fixing to be a big thing in history that's going to take place. It's going to be a reality. Now, that's why I bring you back to this character, Joseph, and I say, "Hey, Austin, how you doing, man? Barely recognize you." And so, remember Genesis 15 with the development of the rest of the book. And so that's why I say, why so much content around Joseph? That goes into what Randy was saying. What will Joseph become as the 11th son of Jacob, the son of Isaac? There's that promised son of Abraham who finally is born after so much up and down struggles with Abram and Sarah and Ishmael and their walk of faith. And remember, Abraham is a major character in the Bible that's referenced as a person to emulate faith after. So why, again, so much content, now that you've looked at Genesis 15, surrounding the character of Joseph? And when you think about Joseph, one word must be in your mind. Maybe more, but one and for sure. And that one word is providence. providence. How many of you have ever considered the providence of God? How God fulfills His will on this earth. When you pray to God today, fast forwarding way in the future, now we're here in the 21st century, when you pray to God, do you still recognize that God is a God of providence? We have a promise that God will come back, Jesus will come in the clouds, and at the loud sound of a trumpet or something, all eyes will see Him. Those that have been buried, those that have gone on before, will be raised. In the moment, in the twinkling of an eye, there's going to be a transitionary thing happen that's amazing, more than we can ever describe. We have that promise. He's coming back. And in the will of God and His providence, He's going to make that happen in His good time. Now, when's that going to be? I don't know. But I have that promise that I know it will happen one day. And my job is to be faithful. Now, Joseph becomes a character study surrounding God fulfilling that thing. And I'm going to say thing because it's that historical factor where this seed line through Abraham, the promised seed, will enter into a foreign land. And we know that foreign land is Egypt. And at first, it starts off kind of fair. Well, not at first with Joseph going in, but through Joseph's good character, he develops a masterful relationship with the Egyptians and creates favor with a foreign people. And as a result, Joseph's family will be saved, spared from the famine. Jacob, the father who thought he lost his son, will get to see his son. Joseph, the brother of Benjamin, will get to see his brother after so many years of captivity. And you have this sweet reunion, and you have a story of redemption, basically. But then you also, through this, will see a story of how God is developing nations around in a way to show a great power that perhaps the world had never seen since the days of Noah and the flood. A great power that would show a God on display who could save a people powerfully from a powerful nation of people, the Egyptians, who were the most organized at the time that we're aware of, dynastic rule, well-known, but yet very pagan. Let me show you something so you can kind of maybe see like a cookie, the cream in the middle. Fast forward with me now to Exodus chapter 12, verse 12. And through Moses, God will get His people out of Egypt. But you remember all the 10 plagues that will take place as a result of Moses? Do we really study or understand what those plagues represented, what God was doing to that nation, Egypt? Look at Exodus 12, verse 12. They're getting ready to leave and get out of Egypt. And look at verses 11 and 12 following. Exodus 12, verses 11 and following. This is the first Passover that was instituted. And he's telling them, "You shall eat it with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff on your hand, in your hand, and ye shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." He's coming. He's going to pass over this land. And if the blood is not applied, if you're not one of God's people, this last and final 10th plague is fixing to devastate the land. Verse 12. "For I will pass through the land of Egypt this night and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast, and against all," what does it say? "The gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. And this day shall be unto you for a memorial, and ye shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. Ye shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. Now, what did verse 12 say those plagues were really an effect upon in the land of Egypt? Yes, judgment against their gods, idolatry. Now, let me ask you another question. So when you go back to Genesis 15 and you see this story being set up, which is a true story, not some mythological story. We still talk about Abram today because we're still talking about his supposed heirs or people over there called Israel, right? So, I mean, this isn't a mythological character. These are real historical events. So when you get now over to the book of Joshua, and they're fixing to go in and take the city of Jericho, do you remember the little simple harlot who spares or hides the spies? Do you remember what the harlot who becomes one ingrained in the genealogy of Jesus Christ? Somehow she's proselyted in through this whole. Do you remember what she says to those spies? This is years after, really. This is the developing of this thing. How many years did they wander in the wilderness after they were delivered? 40. So it's 40 plus years. They had heard, and she says, Rahab the harlot, we have heard what your God did to the Egyptians. You remember that story? In history, that's what was going on back then. And that's the fulfillment of Genesis 15 through the character that was set up in Joseph. So let's go back and briefly analyze some things that may help us understand the context here better. All right, let's look at Genesis chapter 37. One of the first points of interest to me is how this thing is set up. Remember, God knew it would happen. Do you remember Joseph? Look at verse 3. 11th son. Do you remember Joseph and the affection Jacob had towards this son? Look at verse 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. Now, maybe we overanalyze that idea of him showing favoritism to Joseph, but it does say he was the son of his old age. I have an opinion on that. I think the older you probably get, the wiser you get, and you start looking at children and you start realizing how precious they are. But when you first start having them, you don't know what to do with them. And he had those wild first sons who were doing crazy things, and then Joseph comes from his sweet wife Rachel, who, by the way, Rachel was an idolater. You remember after he'd worked 14 years and he finally marries Rachel, they're getting out of his father-in-law's, Laban's father-in-law's country, and they're going back. And you remember Laban chases after him, pursues after him because of something. Do you remember what that something was? What was missing in Laban's house? The idols. And you remember who was sitting on them or who had them hidden? The wife he worked 14 years for is an idolator. You can see a little bit of the frustration with Jacob towards Rachel. You know, what are you doing here? Anyway, these were not always pure people. But nonetheless, back to Jacob. He's an older man. He's had Joseph. And he can look at Joseph probably in a little bit wiser light. The older sons were older and so forth. So he loved his younger son, Joseph. Of course, Benjamin would be the youngest. But look at verse 4. When his brethren saw that their father loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. I want you to note that a first characteristic in the development of Joseph before he is in Egypt, which is how God will get his nation into Egypt and how God will then deliver his nation out of Egypt, it starts with the characteristic of hatred, jealousy, bitterness. They'd all be associated. They couldn't even speak peaceably unto him. And I want you to notice here in regard to that word providence that God is working through hatred. It doesn't mean God was approving hatred. It just means that God knew that this would be the way things would work out. And he allowed them to work out this way. So, through hatred and jealousy, God's will ultimately, in part, will be fulfilled. Y'all see that point? Let me ask you a question. When Jesus was on the cross, or before and up to the cross, right at the time when he was getting crucified, and he was apprehended in the garden, what kind of motivation was going on there with Christ going to the cross? Would you see a little bit of hatred and anger and jealousy and all kinds of bitterness and wrath? And that's the motivation that put Christ on the cross. We call it sin, and it was. But when you think about God's providence, don't misunderstand that God, being omniscient, knowing all things, he will work his will out. He knows you and me. He knows mankind better than even we know ourselves. Always will, always has. He's the creator. That's why I think that passage over there in Genesis 15 when it says the sin of the Amorites is not yet full. That's very indicative. It's a historical gesture. God recognizes a nation of people. By the way, who were the Amorites? You remember where they came from? Yeah. So, God knew this. So when you think about today, let me ask you another question. This is where it gets a little bit interesting to me, not that we should go around trying to make people mad as Christians. But don't let someone's anger or wrath or bitterness deter you from doing what's right. I'm not going to stand in the face of a person and let him say something that's wrong. If I can tactfully, and maybe with a soft answer or using the tools that God has given me to practice, but I've got a responsibility to answer that person. And when I answer that person, the response or the reply is not up to me. The reaction that we get is not up to me. The anger, whatever, it may be peace. What happened when Stephen preached the gospel in Acts chapter 7? They stoned him. But let me ask another question. When I read that story, did that stop the gospel? Or did it advance the gospel? You read towards the end of that chapter, those people were emboldened by the character of Stephen. So, think about the effect attitude and personality plays into the job that we have to do before us. Just notice the hatred and the jealousy that will lead to the Joseph ending up into Egypt. Now watch this. Look at verse 5. He was a dreamer. This is a special ability. Verse 5, Genesis 37, verse 5, Joseph dreamed a dream and he told it his brethren. And they hated him yet the more. I mean, you might sometimes say, Joseph, why don't you just shut up? Why do you keep pouring salt into this wound? But he didn't. And he said unto them, hear, I pray you, this dream which I have dreamed, listen to the dream. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, farmers. These are Bedouin. Remember, God's people were farmers. They were related to animals. They were close to the land. And lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaf stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. What's he saying there in that dream? Y'all are going to be sitting around worshiping my sheaf. You know, it's a bowing down to me. Let me ask you a question. That dream that he had there, which was prophetic, it would be no doubt a special gift that he had from God, which added more salt again to the fire, or, you know, to the wound of hatred, bitterness, envy. God still, he didn't hold back with Joseph. Our God didn't say, well, Joseph, we need to hold back because we want to be politically correct here. We don't want to infuriate your brethren. No, Joseph, you've got a special gift. I've got a special purpose, and you're going to have to be faithful. So he has this dream here, and the question is, does that dream, does it come to pass? When does it come to pass? During the famine. Now go back to when it will come to pass, the fulfillment of that dream. Look at the way Joseph handles that. Do they recognize who he is? But does he recognize who they are? Now look at the way Joseph, when this will come to pass, how he handles that. Think about the very end, before and after, or right when their father Jacob will pass away in Egypt. And you remember what the brothers say after Israel dies in Egypt. Judah and the other brethren begin to become paranoid. And they say of Joseph, he will do what to us because of the way we treated him? You remember that story? And do you remember what Joseph will do to them? Man, I tell you, I'm so tempted to run fast forward and go over there to Genesis 50, because I just want to point it out. I don't have time to fit all this in. But remember what Joseph will say to his brothers. You meant it for evil. God meant it for good. Wow. Now you think about the providence of God. When you think you've got it all figured out in your life, and you think you're smart, and you think, well, I'm going to do everything just perfect. And God's over here working things out through evil. Doesn't mean he approves of it. But just remember, God is all-knowing. Our job's to do right. Don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying go out there and drink beer and do bad things and run with bad people and act like, well, God will work it out for good because I'm going to be evil. I think we have too many people in the church today that are going that direction. I'm just going to be bad and God will work it out for good and I'll still be on God's side. No, that's not what it says. God doesn't excuse the evil, but he can work through these things. Anybody have a comment or question or would like to add to that? Well, look at Genesis 37 and how this is set up, because I think this is amazing. Verse 9, he dreamed another dream. Genesis 37, verse 9. And told it his brethren and said, behold, I have dreamed a dream. And I like the King James Version more. It's kind of like the preacher who says, I'm just going to keep on preaching even though I know you're tired of listening to me. And everybody's out there going, ugh. Alright, so he said, I dreamed a dream more. And, he tells him the dream here. And behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee to the earth? Now stop for a moment. We know the rest of the story, like I've said. But now think about this. Even Jacob, his father, is ignorant to what this dream means. Do you think Jacob had heard the stories about Genesis 15? Do you think that Jacob maybe had heard in passing or maybe directly that, listen, Jacob, God said to your grandfather, Abraham, before Isaac, that our people or this nation, whatever we become, will become a stranger in a foreign nation. I don't know if that transmission of information took place. I would assume, this is my opinion, that something had been communicated. This is the will of God, that there will be some calamity. But here's the point. Jacob, the father of Joseph, does not understand this dream. But again, the question is does that dream come to pass too? Is it fulfilled? Let me ask you, as a nation, if you were in the nation of Israel and you were a part of that group that had gone into Egypt and a part of the group that comes out of Egypt, your salvational message would be in knowing these truths. And the reason I say that is because this is your evidence. When God told Abraham back in Genesis 15 that this would take place, and now you're over here getting out of Egypt and you've experienced these powerful plagues, a mighty strong hand from your God, the God of all of creation, has destroyed the land of Egypt, and yet you can look back by faith and look at how God fulfilled every word, every promise. Even though men like Jacob, Israel, the very name that the nation is named after, didn't get it. What excuse will we have to say, well, I don't get it today? And I would say, in fairness, we probably all do. And that's what the story of Joseph is really all about, to remind us that God fulfills His Word. He will fulfill His Word. So then this is a message of salvation for me today. When I might have a tendency to doubt my own salvation, why? Stop and ask yourself, why? Go back to the book. Read the stories. Whatsoever things are here written aforetime are written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the Scriptures might have hope. And so, this is an amazing story. Any other comments? All right. So look at this. So back to Genesis 37. So his father and mother are going, you mean we're going to bow down to thee? And then look at verse 11. And his brethren, maybe they fed off their father's frustration. His brethren envied him, but his father observed the saying. So there's a little bit of an openness perhaps in Jacob's heart. His brethren went to feed their father's flock, and this is the setup. And Israel said unto Joseph, Do not thy brethren feed the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said to him, Here am I. And he said to go to him, Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he sent him out of the vale of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. A certain man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. The man asked him, saying, What seekest thou? And he said, I seek my brethren. Tell me, I pray thee, where they feed their flocks. And the man said, They are departed hence, for I heard them say, Let us go to Dothan. And Joseph went after his brethren and found them in Dothan. And when they saw him afar off, even before he came near unto them, they conspired against him to slay him. They had it. And they said one to another, Behold, this dreamer cometh. Now, I want you to, again, see the backdrop. These brethren are not wanting to sell him into slavery at this point. His own brothers here are wanting to do what with him? They want to kill him. But that's not what's going to happen. Look at verse 22. The brother Reuben, who is the oldest, I believe, said, Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit that is in the wilderness, and lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands to deliver him to his father again. So you have a sense of, what kind of sense is this? In the scheme of providence. What kind of a person is Reuben, the brother, in the scheme of God's providence? How does he play into this picture? I think about the different levels and degrees of hatred and envy and violence and things that occur as a result. I think Reuben was very much of a part of the envy. He was one of the oldest. He was born of Leah. And that's the first wife. And he probably felt a little entitled maybe. And here's this special son. And now he's dreaming dreams. But Reuben, with all of his envy, has something that holds him back and says, let's shed no blood. And yet then conspires to do something wiser in his own mind. But he doesn't outwise or outsmart God. I want you to see the characters involved with the development of providence. Let's fast forward to Potiphar's house. We're going to run out of time. I knew we would, but you can't give me one subject. You gave me Abraham last time and then Joseph, and I'm like, well, there's a lot of content here. All right, so let's look at Potiphar. Look at verse 36. He ends up in Potiphar's house. Remember, he sold to the Ishmaelites. Who were the Ishmaelites in verse 28? The Ishmaelites are pretty kindred to him. These are all family at this point. Look at verse 35. And all his sons and his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted because, verse 36, the Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh's and a captain of the guard. And so this Joseph is sold into Potiphar's household. Nobody likes to talk about this, but as a part of the experience with human beings, other human beings have been used as collateral or property. That's a fact. Goes back to this, and this is more of your Hebrew classification of people, bloodlines, and so forth. So it's not isolated to one bloodline or anything. People have always done things to people that weren't right or fair. And so you have to keep that in mind. But you remember one thing on Potiphar here that interests me. What kind of a person was Joseph as far as physical appearance is concerned? We didn't read those passages. Do you remember what kind of a person Joseph was physically? I think it talks about him being good looking. If you go back to the early part, he was attractive, he was good looking, and now he's sold into a house where he's a prince over Egypt, Potiphar. And this is another setup. What kind of a wife does Potiphar have? I mean, this is my thinking. She sees this new slave boy come in who's hardworking, he's industrious, he has a good attitude, and he's good looking. And perhaps, opinion, Potiphar, a busy civil servant of the Egyptian dynasty, busy, gone all the time, and here's a mighty fine-looking little servant boy that I can take advantage of. And how does that play out in the scheme of providence? What kind of character is Joseph? He says, no, I couldn't do this thing before God, and he leaves his coat and he flees. And he ends up in prison in a system of chains. He's already a slave, and now he's in a system of chains, and he's with a butler and a baker, and he has to interpret dreams again, and he'll work himself back up. Think about the falls of the pits of Joseph's life, up and down to the eventual... Anyway, the whole story of Joseph is an amazing story. Did he ring the bell? So, when you think about Joseph, a real story, historically accurate, true that affects an entire dynasty, nation of people, the Egyptians. And this is what God knew before with Abraham, how he would deliver his people and get them out and eventually into a promised land through a character named Joshua, who is a servant to who? Who does Joshua get his mentorship from? Moses, a man who is schooled in Egypt, had learned some masterful things, advanced technologies. According to Acts chapter 7, they talk about Moses being educated in all the ways of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians were very sophisticated during their day and age. And this is who Joshua was looking up, but again, a person that God will utilize to create and bring out a story of redemption. So, I think I'd like to make this last comment. When this comes to how to apply this to our lives, Christians should never look at tribulation, trial, even failure as you reckon failure as failure if you're being faithful to God. Does that make sense? And that's the story. And through that, God will always triumph. And He'll show His will as being fulfilled. Our job is to always do what's right and quit worrying about the envy. Now, I'm not saying you should provoke people on purpose, but you're supposed to do what's right no matter what. And you've got to make those decisions, and you've got to make right decisions. And I'm kind of afraid sometimes we make decisions based upon not wanting to hurt people's feelings too much. And we need to let God's will and His Word have its way. And we need to get out of the way, no matter what happens to us. Anyway, those are some thoughts that I hope maybe will help you. And I appreciate your attention.